and welcome to the Senate Revenue Committee. Today we have the presentation of the Oregon Economic and Revenue Forecast. And joining me today is an honored guest, our House Chair of House Revenue.
Thank you.
Senator Lane Chatterley.
Pleasure to be here this year.
Also is Karen Minnis from the Majority Office in the House. And we have the Majority Leader from the Senate, David Nelson, and also Senator Metzger. And others may choose to join us. And as they enter, they can sign in, join us on the dais, or be seated anywhere that they are comfortable. Today we have with us for the presentation of the Oregon's Economic and Revenue Outlook, the quarterly economic revenue forecast for March 1st. As presenters, we have Oregon's version of Alan Greenspan. That would be Tom Petowski.
What did he do wrong that you start on him already?
By Cora Parker, and I think Senator Corcoran already mentioned something about a reward for the messenger.
I didn't say anything. I can say enough on my own to get in trouble. I didn't say anything about any messenger.
Right. And in years past, there's been a press over at the information tables because the reports are not released officially until we gavel in the presentation. We'll actually have a proctor distribute the report so that you can remain seated, and that way there won't be a crush of folks up against the wall trying to get the information. So if
Parker,
we could, then go ahead and call forward Mr.
Gamble
and Cora Parker. They can begin the report, and we'll open the public hearing on the quarterly economic and revenue forecast for March 1st, 2008.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Good morning.
And guests. For the record, my name is Tom Petowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis and Department of Administrative Services.
Well,
good morning.
Morning.
Well, we come to you today with our March 1st forecast. What I'd like to do is provide you with a little overview of how we got to the point where we are today, and the data and analysis which brought us to our conclusions. Which we will be presenting by Cora Parker, our revenue economist, with our outlook for 2001-2003. So to start with, looking at the Oregon economy, one of the processes that we go through in order to come up with this forecast is that we provide both an economic and a revenue forecast. We have pre-meetings that are based on what the national outlook is doing in the economy, because like it or not, as the nation changes, it does affect us here in Oregon. We then do simulations through our modeling. We then meet with both people who are state officials and also with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. They review our preliminary economic forecast, make recommendations. Then we finalize that. That forecast then drives our revenue forecast. We've had quite a ride in the 1990s, and we're starting to see now that what we believed was sort of this new economy where you could no longer have possible recessions or slowdowns in the economy or great disruptions because it now was a new high-tech, productivity-driven, that's come into some question recently. But we've seen that the year 2000 was quite strong for the U.S. economy, but in the fourth quarter, we had a dramatic slowdown to only a 1.1% growth rate. And that's the growth rate that was just released yesterday as a re-estimate of what was happening that last quarter. Expectations are that 2001 will be just as slow as that last quarter. The expansion definitely is showing signs of slowing. Manufacturing in the U.S. is considered to be in recession. Still, unemployment in the U.S. is at some of its lowest levels that we've seen since the 1970s. And inflation, even though we've seen some pockets of it starting to spurt up a little bit, still remains relatively low. The national trends that are impacting our region, first, inflation. The red line is showing our overall consumer price index, overall inflation for households. The yellow line is the what's called a core CPI. It excludes the volatile food and energy. You can see in 1998, we were having some positive, what we call supply shocks. Energy prices were very, very low, and that was very beneficial to bringing overall inflation down. We've just had the opposite of that as we've come in 2000 with oil prices. And then more regionally, we've been seeing some other energy prices in the form of natural gas and electricity that are starting to spike up those prices. But still, the outlook for inflation is that that will be a temporary situation, and overall prices will start to come down. Unfortunately, the reason why they're mostly coming down is because we're having demand coming down because we're having a slowing economy. Incomes were rising, but that is starting to slow, and we're also starting to see consumer spending slowing. It's a great trick if you can have that yellow line above the red. You can spend above what your income is doing, but that's something just can't keep going on forever, and there's got to be a correction coming on soon, and we're starting to see that now.
Mr. Chair?
Question.
Back to the previous slide. Why do you see a bump in 2003 in personal disposable income?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, what we're seeing here is a slowdown in 2001, possibly in 2002. So that's bringing that consumption down. But as the Federal Reserve sort of reacts to that, we have interest rates coming down, businesses get more realigned and balanced in with their inventories, we should then see a growth spurt then occur afterwards. So you have the slowdown, you have the growth, and then when we get out to 05, 06, 07, when you're out to those, getting out to those periods, it's tough then to start to put in what a business cycle might be doing. And so those are sort of more average growths that is believed to be out in those periods.
Thank you.
The Federal Reserve, they engineered a slowdown in the economy. Then they realized that possibly they slowed things down a little too much. And so in January, they lowered rates twice in 1 month. And although there was some hopes that they may do so again before their March 20th meeting, it appears that they may wait for that meeting before they have another rate change. All indications are that it will be another lowering of rates, which should be beneficial to the economy. When will this great expansion end? It's already 9 years and counting. If it makes it through the end of March, it'll be 10 years. And that's the longest expansion on record since records were kept in the late 1800s. But we're definitely in a slowing period, and if at any point in time there was a question mark as to whether the U.S. economy is falling into recession, it's at this period of time. Odds are very close to 50-50 that we are in a recession. So, as I said, the expansion is now the longest in post-war history. It's definitely been a consumer-driven expansion, but as we're seeing right now, consumer spending is starting to slow down. Inflation has increased moderately, but still remains relatively low levels. International markets are still somewhat questionable. We do have risks of recession. We're looking to also the federal government to help out in that respect, the Federal Reserve for one, and also on the fiscal side. With President Bush's tax cuts. Consumer and business confidence are going to be one of the keys, whether we can just have the nice, which now is a more of a bumpy soft landing, and then be able to continue on to some mild growth, or if we're truly into the recession. The real difficult point right now is we're at this sort of inflection point. The data hasn't quite caught up with some anecdotal information we're seeing about layoffs and stuff like that. So it's a very difficult time right now to call exactly what direction the economy is going to head in the next few months. Turning to Oregon's economy, this one's a little hard to see, but we do have your PowerPoints in front of you. And this particular PowerPoint starts on page 6. And this is just a view of the gross state product for Oregon over a 10-year period. And you can see the great increase that's happened with high tech in terms of its value of output. Likewise, you can see the drop in output from lumber and wood products, over a 51% drop, and related industries to that, printing and publishing and paper and allied products have also declined. This real gross state product, also same graph essentially, but what I want to point out to you here is that if you look at manufacturing, in 1988, it was about 20% of our overall output value to us. In 1998, that has risen up to 28.4%. Just below that, we have a subtitle called durable goods manufacturing, almost 14% in 1988, but now almost double, 25% in 1998. And the story I want to hear, we hear a lot about the Oregon economy being a much more diversified economy, and that's definitely true. The service sector has grown rapidly. We've also changed from mainly a natural resource-based economy to one more mixed with high-tech and also services. But we're still having a higher concentration in the durable manufacturing area. It's that we're still, in a sense, a manufacturing state, but we just make different things than we did before. And durable manufacturing is a volatile sector of an economy, and it's subjected to the business cycles, and it moves up and down, more so than, say, the service sector does. So when we have a slowdown in the economy, and there's slowdown in manufacturing, we are going to feel the effects of it quite a bit.
If we could revisit that point for a moment, the durable goods manufacturing sector has changed from primarily agricultural and forest products into food processing and high technology manufacturing, but it doesn't mean that we've completely divorced Oregon's economy from the cyclical nature of manufacturing economies.
That's a correct assessment, Senator.
Okay, I think people are surprised at some point that we still are in a cyclical type of system with its heavy reliance on durable goods manufacturing. In other words, many people believe that we traded agriculture and wood products manufacturing for high-tech industries that was much more insulated from the cycles. We did change the structure of our economy, but not away from durable manufacturing. So it's a high-tech manufacturing that's still possibly not as cyclical as food processing and manufacturing of forest products, but it's still a cycle.
Yes, that's true, Senator. What we do, though, have, might say, is that probably high tech is still in a growth phase in economic activity. When things revive, demand returns to that sector, we should see some pretty robust growth for that sector. But once again, it is, just as you characterized, subject to the business cycles and fluctuations.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
I want to ask one of my uninformed questions. What is FIRE, F-I-R?
Oh, I'm sorry. FIRE stands for Finance, Insurance, and Real Estate.
Mr. Vice Chairman?
Tom, just looking at these, it's surprising me, and I guess it's the value shift, because if you look at the labor numbers, this was an employment chart, my perception at least is that Oregon has mirrored the national movement from manufacturing into employment being concentrated in services and trade. But clearly, this shows that in terms of the value of the state product to have shifted the other way.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's absolutely right. When we've pushed into the manufacturing area, they tend to be high value products, and so that's what this chart is. Accentuating is that value aspect that's been added to the economy. But in terms of employment, you're absolutely right. It's the service area where we've seen some of the greatest employment growth occur.
Is it fair to say that Oregon's economy has shifted even more towards an exporting economy, exporting in a broader sense out of state and internationally more than it was 10 years ago?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think that's a fair assessment. I'm going to have a chart in a little bit that shows our exports, and you can see that the overall value of exports has gone up dramatically in the 1990s.
That's good. Bringing money in.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, accepted.
Senator Minnis?
Not all money. Can you explain to me the relationship between lumber and wood products, which appears to be down almost 52%? Whereas construction is up 115%. I'm assuming that they use a lot of wood products in construction, and I guess the question is, where are they getting these materials?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think you've almost answered your own question by the end when you said they hit their material.
And if he doesn't, the person next to him does.
In that, the lumber and wood products industry in Oregon has seen both in terms of, I might call it, they're hit on the supply side and they're hit on the demand side sometimes at the same time. The supply side, the availability of timber to be able to be cut, forests that are available, the supply has been restricted for various reasons. On the demand side, whenever we've had cycles occur in the economy, especially the latest one where we've had the mortgage rates go up in the year 2000, that also hurt that industry. Then when the price of lumber has risen quite dramatically, that also opens the door for substitutes. I gave a talk a while ago at there's a place called the Bureau of Ceiling and Wall Association. And the one thing that struck me there is they were having their it was the North Regional meetings were coming up, and they had a long list of all their workshops. There wasn't a single workshop on wood. It was all on using plastic and concrete and steel beams. And so you're having these inroads being made by these substitutes, plus lumber itself, be it from Canada, South America, the competition is very, very tough. So when we had the great growth occurring in Oregon, materials were coming in here to supply that growth. But proportionally, it wasn't coming from Oregon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Question, Senator Corker.
Can you give a overview of what your description of government is in terms of provision of, is that from a viewpoint of provision of services? How do you get to that statistic?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corker. This statistic, this is a view of the sort of the value of services that's provided by the government, their involvement in overall, in a sense, economic activity in the state.
So, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. So you see a drop of about 33%. So does that mean it's dropping as a proportion of the total gross state product, or does that mean it's dropping in and of itself?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, the government value of output has risen over this time, period of time, in absolute numbers, but as a overall percentage of activity, it's fallen.
Okay. Thank you.
Things were going great in 1990 until we got to about the middle of 1998, where we really started to slow, and this graph shows a comparison with our neighbors to the north and south of us. We were growing quite strongly, as you can see, in 95, 96, but then in 98, we really started to slow quite a bit. And the result of this was the Asian financial crisis. And the important part about this goes back to the point of our sort of manufacturing base we have in the economy. Our manufacturing base is more diversified, but if all these industries get hit equally, it's as if you had one major industry that was being impacted. And with the Asian financial crisis, it hit our agriculture, hit our lumber and wood, it hit our high tech too. So all these sectors started to soften at the same time. Our export volume, the red line shows our overall volume, and that's with the left vertical axis shows the values there. And you can see that red line has really grown over time. It's gotten quite large. But the yellow line, which shows the growth, you can see the devastating effects that the Asian financial crisis had, where we were in the negative growth range as we got into 96, 97, and didn't get out of it till about 99.
Question, Representative Shatter.
Thank you, Tom. Exports, are those international exports, or are we talking about exports to other states as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shatterly, these are international exports. You can see the real rebound. The Asian financial crisis, they got their act together, the country started to revive, our exports really started to grow, and then we started to have now a slowdown once again as we got into the year 2000. And essentially what we're having here is a situation where we had the Asian financial crisis from an international perspective causing us some problems. Then these countries started to soften just a little bit from, in a sense, an energy problem to them. The Asian countries are almost 100% dependent on the import of oil for their economies. And when the price of oil was rising rapidly in that period of time, that also tended to soften them just a little bit. Our exports, you can see that Asia dominates the areas where we send our exports to. And that's been true, really, for quite a while. But it's even more so important in present days. And this graph, by the way, goes out to 2000, quarter three is the latest information we have. Japan used to dominate as our biggest export market, but lately they've faltered, and they've been in a tough situation for really since the mid-1990s. Their expectation is that hopefully they're going to do a little bit better. They seem to be getting back on their feet somewhat. And they have, as you can see right at the end of 99, they have increased their exports from us once again. But newcomers, South Korea, also Canada, have been quite strong exporters for us.
Mr. Vice Chair.
In that last chart, Korea was, remember, the last few quarters, Korea has been a top trading partner, and they're heading down again. It seems like their financial problems, restructuring of their economy has had them in trouble. Are you seeing that, or is that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think that's correct. The interesting thing about Korea, though, as opposed to Japan, is they decided to say, well, let's face up to this. We've got some really tough decisions to make. I don't think you'd see Japan at all trying to sell a major company on the open market to try to revive it somewhat. So I think with their situation, we've seen sort of a sharp drop in their activity, but they're already starting to bounce back a little bit. And I think that they've taken the right move to face up to the financial situation, and at least the services that we use that take a look at growth for these countries, they see Korea starting to bounce back.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis, is there anything there?
Maybe a tangential question, but the Port of Portland, how important is its operation in relation to this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it is important. And we just had, of course, the news of the closing down of the, is it Ever? I wish I could, I don't have the exact name of the company that was running some of the port.
Evergreen
facilities out that is going to close down. That will be somewhat disruptive for us. But my understanding is that quite a few companies already, because of the stiff competition that's been happening in shipping, that some companies are already shipping out of Tacoma that are located in the Portland area because these shipping companies are providing rail transport for, at no cost to get to ship the stuff. So I think it's going to be a little bit disruptive, but there still are avenues of where shipping has been occurring out of the area.
Representative Shatterly, thank you. Tom, what's going on with Mexico there? They're trailing in the bottom and then shoot up, and all of a sudden they fall off as precipitously with everybody else down at the bottom. Doesn't show much confidence in the governor's last trading visit. What's that all about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shatterly, Representative Shatterly. Mexico, our guess is what's happening here is in 99, through the NAFTA agreement, we're seeing a lot more trade coming into the U.S. Also, they ran into a real problem with their trucking industry, that their trucks just weren't very safe. And I think they made a real move to upgrade their their trucks to transport stuff, and the beneficiary of that was Freightliner, and a lot was sent down there. That part of this, I think, now is they've made that big push. It's happened, and now that's starting to recede a little bit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran is recognized.
I would notice from the graph that there's a slight lip upwards after the governor's visit, and I think that's attributable to Senator Castillo.
The Castillo effect.
The Castillo effect, that's right.
Senator Corcoran, your astute observation on trade missions, notwithstanding, I think it's too soon to predict what the Castillo effect is.
And I'm not going to touch the trucking deregulation issue that Mr. Piotrowski raised either, sir. Okay. It's not my place.
In point of fact, I think he observed that Freightliner was a beneficiary because they sold a lot of rolling stock in Mexico because of the upgrades that were necessary. So, and I think it was an improvement in safety and transportation for all Americans. Good things for us. Let's proceed, Mr. Piotrowski.
This is the growth of actually the levels for different sectors, and you can see the dominance of what has happened with high technology. And as when I've shown this graph before, I usually tell people that right at sort of 95, you can sort of write Intel on that graph, and that pretty much explains that big bump up there. You can also see that agriculture was doing very well up to about 96, and then that has also softened quite a bit. But we're starting to look at some slight improvement here as we got into 2000. Lumber and wood still on a decline over time. And that looks like maybe it's stabilizing out, but it's been fairly soft for them. Also, you can see we just mentioned the transportation equipment. Almost non-existent there, that dashed line on the bottom, but it really picked up as we started to get into the 99 period, and now once again it's starting to soften. They really got hit by both the combination of the higher interest rates that occurred and the higher gasoline prices, and that really started to choke off their sales. The transportation equipment also includes the RVs, like Monaco Coach. Our outlook then, we want to just sort of a reminder, we've now have sort of a more maturing Oregon economy. I think we've gone through this sort of high-tech change from a natural resource-based economy. We still have some great vulnerability to national and international shocks, and we also are subject to what we might call the California effect. We were beneficiaries of the California effect when California was not doing very well in the beginning of the 1990s, and correspondingly we started to have a high-tech expansion here and needed the workers to fill that, and California had a surplus of workers at the time, and that's where we had the huge in-migration occur.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Tom, with the diversification, I guess it is that we diversified, although we concentrated in another area. Does our state economy more closely the movements in the national economy now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, it does. We do reflect more of what's happening in the U.S. economy. Our situation before used to be that the U.S. economy would go into a recession. Oregon would be sort of a latecomer to the recession. But as it went in, it would go in much deeper than the U.S. average would. And then as the U.S. economy on average started to recover, the Oregon economy lagged and took a while before it started to recover and was much slower. Boom periods, too, Oregon was much higher than the U.S. economy. Now we're starting to see more coincidence-type movements between the U.S. average and what's happening in Oregon. This is our outlook for overall... Oh, I'm sorry. No, it isn't. I got ahead of myself one slide. What I wanted to show you here is just comparing the recession of 1991 and looking at Oregon employment growth and also what Oregon employment growth had looked like in the last 3 years, ending in 2000. What I want to point out specifically here is you can see in the red line, it only took two quarters from a very high growth position. Of 4% and above, almost 5% growth, and in two quarters going to negative job growth. So when you have a downturn, these things can happen very, very quickly. It wasn't a very deep, though, downturn. It didn't last too long. And then we started to come back out. Comparatively, last 3 years, we've been sort of in this slow growth phase where we've been bouncing around sort of the 2% level on a quarterly basis. So we've not had the same situation in terms of actually seeing what we might say recession numbers like we did in 91, but we are experiencing, for the past 3 years, relatively slow economic growth in the state. But still, the point here is it's still positive. It's slow, but still positive. Here's our expectation. The red line is Oregon employment growth. The yellow is U.S. You can see that we were doing quite better than the U.S. for quite a while. Also in the 91 recession, you can see how we pretty much mirrored what the U.S. was doing, followed it along very closely. There wasn't any lag or lead to what we were doing. But the tone of this graph, you look from left to right, it slopes downwards. And we've been slowing in growth across time. Our expectation is that we won't have a recession, although, like I said, we're getting close to calling it 50-50 here. But we're going to have growth below 1% in 2001. And actually, our expectation is that employment growth will be about 0.7%. Which is a fairly slow growth, slower than we've seen in the past 10 years. We expect that to be somewhat short-lived, though, and we expect to bounce back up in 2002, where we expect growth to be above 1%, and then reach into the 2% range in 2003. Lumber and wood product growth, this chart, just to show you, the things have not been very pleasant for this industry. There's been downsizing for a long time here. We expect things, though, to stabilize a little bit, especially with mortgage rates having come down. That should help some housing starts again. That should help this industry stabilize a little bit. But we're not looking for a boom period in this industry whatsoever. High tech, and I think this is also illustrative of the volatility that can occur in economy. You can see these big valleys and mountains on this graph. You see that 99, it took quite a dive. But coming out of 99, we've seen tremendous growth in 2000 in the high-tech industry. But saying that, that high growth ended with the fourth quarter of 2000. As example of this, Intel announcing that it has indefinitely postponed its expansion of its R&D facility. Now it has postponed certain wage increases for a certain sector of its employment. So these are aspects where just where they thought, say last October, that things were going to be great and they were gearing up for some great years ahead, very rapidly these fortunes have changed and they've had to reassess their revenue forecast, bring those down dramatically, and also basically tighten up on their costs. Housing starts and prices increase. We've seen them slow. We expect those to pop back up a little bit. We're already seeing that a little bit, and this is because we've had the mortgage rates being very high in 2000, but they've already slid below 7% in this year. They're bouncing around that level. We expect them to even probably slide a little bit further down from that, but that should help out the housing industry somewhat. Not as strong as they've been in the 1990s, but should assist them. Likewise, construction growth, we've had some, as you can see, some large growth periods there, especially in the mid-1990s, but that also is coming down, and we expect that to be moderately positive. Construction's done extremely, in my mind, well, given the slowdown that we've seen in housing. And part of this is that in the 99-2000 period, there's a commercial side helped out construction, whereas the residential side was somewhat soft. We're probably going to see a little bit of reversal of that now as we're coming into 2001, where residential side, because of the lower mortgage rate, should pick back up a little bit, but it's the commercial side then that's going to start to slow. As we look ahead, consumers still remain the key to growth, and this is the finally, I shouldn't say finally, but we now are finally seeing consumer spending slowing down. And that's not something we've seen in this expansion period before. Asian markets, we expect those still to help out demand for Oregon products. Still some risks remain. I'll talk about those in a second. And we expect Oregon to grow, again, faster than the U.S., but it's nothing to write home about. We're just going to be growing real slow, but the U.S. is going to grow slower than we are. So the real story is we're headed for very slow growth, at least through 2001, before we start to see things pick up. This period of time where we've grown faster than the U.S. has allowed us to increase our personal income relative to the U.S. The blue line here shows the U.S. average. You can see that it's been a very gut-wrenching period for Oregon as a state, moving from the natural resource base to a more mixed manufacturing-based economy. We've gained back again on our per capita income and our average wages, but you know, it's 3 years counting, and we're still not back to where we were in the mid-1970s.
That's true.
Senator
Cook, can you explain the difference between per capita income and average wage? Why there's a greater distance in the average wage from the U.S. average?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, your income measure is going to include a lot more items in it than the wage and salary item will. So you have your dividends, your interest will be in your income measure, where your wage is basically salaries.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Tom, just clarification question. You don't need to go back, but the growth trends you showed for employment in the high tech, does that include software?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that does not include software. This is just the manufacturing definition that we have for this sector. I should add, we are going to go in the process of rethinking our definition for high tech. The new standard industrial classifications are going to be coming out and in full force in a couple of years. They've realigned where software fits in. And we've also talked with the Oregon Electronics Association also about this, and that's something we're looking into to change. Per capita income growth has not been even across all the counties over this period of time. The 1998 figures are in, but the picture pretty much stays the same as we have for this 90 through 97 period. You can see that the Upper Willamette Valley has had the greatest increase in per capita income growth, along with Benton County. And the least, of course, has been in the Sherman, Gilliam, Morrow, Wheeler area, the sort of heavy agricultural area. This forecast, we think it's the baseline. We think this is what's going to happen. There's a sort of annoyance out there that the world changes on you as you're trying to have this forecast come true. And we're trying to guess what direction the world's going to go in. But there are definite risks. And we have some macroeconomic policy risks. And either these could be that the economy growth in Oregon is going to be stronger than we expect, or it could be weaker than we expect. We have President Bush's tax cut that we think will help the economy. But the problem here is that by the time that they actually come up with the actual cut, it could be late in this year. And we're still not quite sure of the size of it or whether there's going to be that retroactive payment or not. So based on that, the expectation is that at least in 2001, there may not be much of an impact from this. Plus, if it's phased in over the years, the initial phase-in may not be much of an impact for the economy, and likewise for the Oregon economy. Mr. Greenspan and Company, They have the ability to move very, very quickly if they need to cut interest rates. And we've already seen that last January 3rd. But our problem here is that interest rates work very slowly through the economy. And they usually take about 9 to 12 months before we really start to see their full impact take place. So, in essence, you know, we might like to think macroeconomic policies can possibly help us out right now in 2001, but I think the cards have been set. It's not going to be till late 2001, depending on what they can do today.
Mr. Vice Chair?
Tom, that largely the effect of both of those are driven by that changes that is in consumer confidence. You're not going to, even if rates are really low, you're not going to spend money to improve your capital assets if you don't think you can sell more profit. Likewise, if the tax cuts come in and the consumers don't feel like they're going to have a job, they're not going to spend the money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's right. What they can do here is set the right environment so that once that consumer confidence can come back, then the economy can take off. So these policies are designed to do that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look over at Japan, who has extremely low interest rates, you know, it's fine. You can have a great situation to undertake investments, but if you don't see any return on the investment, you're not going to undertake it to begin with, regardless of how low the interest rate is. International conditions. Asian countries are expected to have some reasonable growth in 2001. In fact, a little bit stronger than what the U.S. overall and what Oregon's growth would be. That should assist Oregon exports. Japan still remains a question mark, and they are a major trading partner with us. Also, if oil prices increase dramatically, that could also hurt the Asian countries who are almost 100% dependent on that oil for their energy needs.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
Asian countries, can you, which one are you talking about? China, are you talking about Vietnam, you talking about...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we're talking Malaysia, China, Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, Philippines.
China is included in that.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Are you aware of any hope, I guess, in the China markets, or is there anything going on there that is promising, or in other words, is the Chinese government opening up to additional trade, or, you know, if the business community is looking more to China?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, my understanding is that things are looking somewhat more positive for China. There was some worry about its exchange rate, its foreign reserves. That seems to have cleared up somewhat. And with trade agreements getting a little stronger between China and the U.S., there is, I think, some positive aspects. Energy prices. We don't have enough slides to cover this topic. But what we are looking at is natural gas prices should soften a little bit as the winter comes to an end. Natural gas does have one of the advantages. It's truly a deregulated market. And so when we start to get some spikes in the prices, we generally do have more drilling occur and more generation coming forward. So we should see that start to abate a little bit. Wet weather in the next few months is crucial for hydro generation. Last report I heard on the radio was something like we're at about 65% snowpack. That's bad news, definitely for us, because if we don't have the hydro generation, generally the way we can get generation has been now through natural gas burning turbo engines that generate electricity. And if that's the case, then these natural gas prices are also going to not soften. So it's a very worrisome situation. Price spikes still are very possible, both in electric and natural gas over the next few years. Rolling blackouts, production stoppages could still happen. And these, you know, there's been some devastating aspects now from this energy problem. In my mind, though, we have the California situation, which is a combination of both their higher demand, their botched deregulation approach, Their problem, I believe, is going to persist a little bit longer than what our situation persists.
Is that what you were referring to earlier as the California effect?
This is one of the effects, yes, from California that we have up here, where we are sending them. We were trading very nicely in the past, sending them electricity down when we didn't need it as much, and then they're sending it back when we need it more.
Isn't there a chance in that, though, that if there's a perception, particularly among the energy-hungry technology companies, that energy is more stable in the Northwest, that that might be an encouragement for the growth at some level that we've seen in the early 90s?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that does appear to be a possibility, at least statements that Intel representatives have made down in California, very concerned about the stability, the reliability of electricity down there, and mentioning that places that they would plan to expand would still be places like Oregon.
No, the California effect was not flip-flops and Hawaiian shirts, Mr. Vice Chairman, but does that also refer to the reservoir effect of population moving from a declining economy in California to Oregon, as we've seen in the past?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is a possibility. If we have a situation where the California economy bogs down because of their regional energy problem and businesses slow there, if we have some growth here occurring, that is, we will get that sort of, I believe, that sort of in-migration occur.
Actually, even with a flat economy in Oregon, there is sort of a recapturing effect that happens in the California real estate market. If people believe that the real estate markets are beginning to flatten in California, they'll sell and recapture their capital gains. And looking at the West Coast housing markets, though Portland's had some of the hottest housing increases in decades, it's still far below what people find in comparable housing in California.
Yeah.
And we find people moving north, purchasing housing, even though they're looking to buy a job or bring a career with them. The relative lower housing costs here, relatively higher values here, bring people out of California where they have a flattening economy.
And Mr. Chair, I might add, too, that in our recent slowdown that we've seen, really starting in 98, where we've had slower growth relative to the other western states, we were closing the gap of our housing cost advantage to both California and Washington, especially the Seattle area. But now that's reversed a little bit. As our housing prices started to slow up and California was exploding and also the Seattle area started to take off again, that gap started to widen again. So we've, in essence, had a little bit of, if you want to call it benefit, of this way of looking at it, where our housing advantage, still, though, not as great as it was before, but has gotten a little better.
Senator Vinnis, you had a question?
I do. How much credibility would you ascribe to conservation energy in terms of mitigating some of the rolling blackouts and kind of the fear factor that's out there with respect to prices?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, in a very, very short run look, if we're looking at getting through a couple of months or 6 months period of time, I think conservation can really help because there's now very little you can do on the generation side to bring that back. So I think it is quite helpful. Plus, even though we see very strange resource use in the idea of like an aluminum smelter that says let's shut down and we'll sell the energy back to Bonneville, and that is more advantageous, and that can be very disruptive on certain regions of the state that depend on those jobs for aluminum smelters. That type of energy comes back to, in a sense, help prevent rolling blackouts from industries that are still using the energy. I will add, though, that I think with the conservation, you have to bite the bullet and you have to allow those prices to increase. That is the best signal to both getting people to reduce their consumption and also to provide the signal for new generation. It causes distributional effects. People on lower incomes are impacted by this. And possibly something, you know, can be worked out to help that, alleviate that. But I think without some of the price increases occurring, we're not going to get that generation to come. And that's a true, in a way, a true conservation method.
But Mr. Chairman, again, I guess you'd agree that supply is an important component of that. Conservation is also important, but it's short term. How do you do that and not perpetuate the fear factor and the paranoia? Kind of thing, I guess, that's been going on in California, where people assume that there's a crisis. We use terms like crisis, and in effect, we're really trying to encourage behavior and then move to a place where we have additional supply. How do you, as an economist, I guess, how do you do that? How would you give that message to the public if you had to do it? Because I'm going to have to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think people have to see that you're not going to have these rolling blackouts. If speaking strictly as an economist, we always concentrate on the price signals. And if you have the price up high enough, you will have demand drop, and you will not have the rolling blackouts. And by not having the rolling blackouts, I think that will be a more confidence builder than, say, have the rolling blackouts to scare people into conservation. It's not maybe the best of answers, but...
Well, I just think, Mr. Chairman, again, we have to talk about this. I think we have to have people like yourselves who can communicate that to individuals so that we don't have, I think, an attitude or perception in the public in Oregon that there's this huge imminent crisis, but rather it's a situation that we recognize is problematic, and there are things and measures that we can do to alleviate those concerns. That message has to be out there. Conservation is an important component.
Oh, there it is.
Nice thought, Senator Minnis.
That was yeah. Plate in my head, I think. Anyway, hopefully you understand my point. I'm trying to get you on record saying some things that I can quote sometime.
Well, this committee has been grappling with some incentives for energy conservation, and we've put forth some legislation that will... incent alternative energy devices and supplies, and I think this legislature will be looking at fast-track energy siting legislation soon. But the idea is that higher energy costs will stimulate investment in energy production. That's part of the equation. We've really ignored conservation over the past 10 years as energy prices stayed low. So even though I believe we are in an energy crisis, I think the crisis creates tremendous opportunity for individuals in Oregon to do in their own homes and lives the conservation things that we've kind of ignored, and for our state as a programmatical approach to increase capacity that may serve us all better in the long run. So I guess with every crisis, there's opportunity. If you proceed, please.
Stock market, I used to predict this.
Coincidentally, this is exactly the same information I get from my stock broker.
Right.
I object to an economist with a sense of humor, Mr. Chair.
The important part, though, about what direction the stock market actually may end up in, incidentally, the NASDAQ, I think, dipped below 2,100 today.
So this is the one of the 50s represents the NASDAQ, and the other 50 represents the other markets. In
yes. As of yesterday, it was down to 1998 levels, and that's true definitely as of this morning. The problem here is that we could have a reverse wealth effect. People that were increasing, the level of their homes, car buying, stuff like that. Definitely these big ticket items can be impacted by the wealth effect working in reverse, where now they're not going to be spending that because of their stock prices going down. Also, there's a psychological effect. If the public is characterizing the markets as being an indication of economic well-being, then when these markets come down, they may also lose their confidence. And when they lose their confidence, they do things like decrease their spending and try to increase their saving. Increasing saving is good, but if everybody does it very rapidly, it's very disruptive to the industries and businesses.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bennis.
Kind of, again, I don't know how it plays into this, but thinking about debt load, debt-to-income ratios of the average Oregonian, does that play into consumer confidence and spending? And are we higher? Do you have any idea? Oregons carry more credit or debt than other states? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Bennis, I don't know specifically for Oregon relative to the U.S. as a whole.
Is that even a factor?
It is a factor. As people build up their debt-to-income, they were also willing to do this because their wealth-to-income is at historical highs. It's come down somewhat now, but it's still quite high relative to where it was just 10 years ago, so that they feel that they can handle that sort of higher debt. When they feel that they can't is when they say, well, now's the time to get my house truly back in order here. It's a little out of whack, and I need to start to not get this debt down. And to when they start to act that way, that's when we have the decrease in the spending.
I have a question related to that. There's been an incredible growth in the money supply in the past decade. If you look at the creation of credit debt, that's one indicator, but just the capacity, the credit capacity that people have is tremendous. It's just exponentially greater than it was a decade ago. And there has been an incredible increase in wealth. If wealth does not go to the stock market, where does it go? People, you mentioned savings, but Americans typically only carry 2 or 3% of their gross income in savings. If the stock market appears not to be a good place for people to put wealth, what is the trend that people use as an alternative to the stock market? And Senator Corcoran, with your reverse wealth theory, perhaps you should listen very carefully to what this gentleman says.
That's a chronic wasting disease for Democrats, Mr. Chair, reverse wealth. We just watched you guys collect it all. I think it's all in your back pocket. I know the answer to this question.
Where does it go? Where does money flow when it doesn't go to the stock market?
Mr. Chair, one is that if you can get out of the stock market before it goes down, one of the places it can flow is in thin air. You had the high price stock, and once it falls, it's gone.
That's so, what we call the Corcoran effect. Thin air.
The other place is you look for safety. Treasury bills and bonds tend to be a place where people, if they were going to transfer their portfolio around, would go into those areas. And then that's also in somewhat beneficial because as people are wanting to buy more treasury bills and bonds, that tends to bring down the rates on those assets.
Well, it's in a paroxysm of national responsibility, we're busily eliminating treasury bills and bonds as an investment vehicle for Americans as we pay billions down on the national debt. These are less available investments for Americans. So at the same time, the stock market is flattening and even reversing value, and we've created such wealth, we're paying down on the national debt. The traditional havens for money are shrinking. So I think we're looking at what's the other hand?
Well, Mr. Chair, you have other options of you can put it in real assets. I think that's one of the more sort of scare tactics that people may take, which is gold, artwork. They can put it in their houses.
Real estate.
So they're going, and that may be, I think, when there's a real fear of a complete collapse, that's when people, I think, go to the real assets rather than alternative financial assets.
Well, I guess what I'm looking at is, or looking for, is a direction for this pent-up wealth that's away from the stock market. And it could, if it turns out to be real property, it could stimulate...
You're looking for investment advice.
Can we find out how broke we are, Mr. Chair?
How broke are we?
Thank you.
I'll quickly go through these. High-tech industry, in the near term, we could even see more of a slowing in the high-tech industry than what's been announced so far. Likewise, I think because we're still somewhat of a growth industry, as we come out of the slowdown, we could see even stronger growth than we expect in our forecast. This is just a review of those risk factors. And
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly has a question.
Just to note that you didn't list earthquakes on the risk factors.
Well, we, Mr. Chair, Senator, Representative Shetterly, we had the PowerPoint put together just before that occurred.
And the power went out.
So with that, what you've all been waiting for, Cora Parker with the revenue outlook.
Oh, sure, delegate the bad news.
That worked out.
They might not have a sense of humor, but they're smart, Mr. Chair.
That fact is not lost on me. All right, what we've all been waiting for. I'm actually going to walk through the forecast a little bit different than we usually do. I'm going to focus just on lottery to start with so it doesn't get lost in sort of the message of where general fund is going. Then we'll talk about the general fund forecast and then a little bit of discussion about the kicker, because I think when we came before you at the beginning of the session, we talked about some timing issues with the kicker and how it could either impact or not impact 0103. So we'll talk some more about that. And then something we added to the revenue section this time in the main document that we haven't had in there for a while at least, and that's risks. Tom always talks about, well, what are the risks to the economic side? Well, there are risks to the revenue side as well. So we broke those out explicitly for you this time, so we'll move through that as well. So on to lottery. Starting with 1999-01, the current biennium, as you may all recall, we have an agreement with lottery to transfer at the closed session level, which was $580.4 million. That is remaining, so they'll transfer at that level with reversion, some interest earnings, and some other resources that are going into the fund. We're actually going to be at $600.9 million for total lottery resources. You see that went down just slightly. Part of that was because of a loss in interest earnings. There's a net effect. Some of the dedicated funds, for example, Sports Action goes directly to higher ed. Sports Action went slightly down this time, so you'll see that. Anyway, just very minimal changes to the 99-01 forecast for lottery. We're looking at an ending balance of 5.5, which rolls forward to your beginning balance for 2001-03. We've seen an increase in the amount that we expect for lottery transfers for 0103, $11.4 million to be exact from the December forecast. We're looking at total resources of $634.4 million. And dedicated distributions, again, have gone up because as revenues and transfers go up, the 15% that comes off for Parks and Rec or for education endowments, those go up as well. So on net, you've added 6.9 to what you have available for lottery allocation. This is the chart that we like to show to you just to just explain that we feel that revenues have sort of stabilized from where they were in the past. We saw when video first came on that there was a big increase to the amount of money that was being transferred from the lottery. And we saw sort of an impact from casinos, the tribal casinos. And now we've got to a position where we feel that that's stabilizing at least. But the amount that you have available, undedicated, has decreased and is going to continue to decrease as debt service increases, or just as, you know, the revenues increase, also what you're picking off for these dedicated funds is going up as well. So the amount you have available has decreased over time. So that was lottery in a nutshell, and if you don't have any questions, I will move on to the general fund. The 9901 forecast for the general fund has increased from December. Actually, the personal income tax forecast, we are bringing down for the remainder of the biennium, but actuals for last quarter were so far above forecast, they offset some of what we're pulling down. So on net, it went up by $18.5 million. Corporate income tax revenue, we're bringing down by $16.6 million. And other revenues is up by $24.9 million. That's largely Medicaid upper limit or Medicare upper limit money that was not included in the December forecast that is now available for transfer. There's also a small piece of that was an increase in the cigarette tax forecast. But for the most part, it's mule money, as it's called. So we're looking at net of an increase of $26.8 million to the 9901 forecast, which means there's still a kicker, and it's even bigger than it was before. And we'll talk about the implications of that later on when we get to that discussion. Looking at 2001-03, your beginning balance is slightly larger because of the increase to 01-99 revenues. The personal income tax revenue forecast is down by $137.8 million. Corporate income tax is just slightly down, but that's masked somewhat the fact that there's no longer a corporate kicker. So we actually got all that back. That was close to $30 million, and it helped to offset what we're actually bringing it down. So while it looks like it's not down much, in fact, the forecast part of it is down more than it shows here. Other revenues are down just slightly, and that's a decrease in cigarette tax monies that are expected to come in. So on net, general fund for 0103 is down by $113.4 million. 0305 and 0507, we don't usually talk about that when we do the release for you, but I just thought it was important to just sort of show you where we are projecting those to be. I know the discussion has been about sustainability and where are we moving forward as you're going through your budgeting process. So you're looking at growth in total general funds of about 14.8%. You'll see that all others, there's a big decrease there. That's because we don't expect as much coming in for the Medicaid upper limit, and there's some other smaller other general fund pieces that we don't expect to be as large as they are in either the current biennium or the 0103 biennium.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
With respect to the 0507 forecast, what assumptions are you using? I mean, if you're forecasting out 5 years, it seems to me somewhat difficult to make those assumptions. So.
Chair Ferrioli and Senator Minnis, you're correct. As Tom mentioned, when you get out into 0507 on the economic side, it's difficult to talk about where business cycles are actually going to be, and so you're looking more at an average sort of growth. And because those same economic figures are what drive into the revenue forecast, that's true here as well for the revenue forecast. So that's probably the most volatile piece of the forecast.
But again, I guess from how did you get from point A to point B, what assumptions did you use? Did you just take the current forecast and just carry forward the same assumptions that the economy was going to continue to slow, or did you add back a bump, or did you, I mean, what did you do?
Senator Minnis, it follows the exact, that you know, you saw that sort of trend. I'm trying to think back to the chart that Tom had that sort of went down and then went up and then just sort of kind of averaged out. Those economic variables actually go straight into the revenue forecast, and 0507 goes through the exact same process that the earlier that the current and the 0103 biennium go through. So
you didn't make any additional assumptions about that. You're just basically carrying that average forward.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, in our economic model, we're projecting out, as you saw, out to 07, for example, employment growth. That employment growth is across various industries. Within that employment growth, we also know what sort of average salaries and wages are and what they may be in the future, estimated. And so you get some views of what are average salaries, wages, what are interest rates supposed to do out to that point, based on, once again, sort of a long-term view. That's going to affect interest incomes. So all that, as an example, works into coming up with sort of a measure of personal income for the state out in those periods. And once you've got that sort of measure, you apply the tax rates and so on to that to try to get an estimate of what personal income taxes would be.
Right. So would you characterize this as a pessimistic outlook in 507, or we don't know?
Mr. Senator, I would say it's not a pessimistic outlook. Mm-hmm. It's saying that if what we think is getting close to sort of a long-term average trend growth mm-hmm. for the state, this is about where we expect it to be.
You didn't make any assumptions about growth in China or
no.
world markets, any of those kind of things changing dramatically?
No, well, no, we did not.
Looking at where general fund revenues have been sort of long term, I think I've brought this before the committee before, this just shows where we were prior to the decade of the 80s and how we moved through the 80s and 90s and where we expect to be out into the next few biennia. Doesn't tell you a whole lot unless you compare it to sort of some average long-term growth and where inflation has been over the period. This chart, as you can see, shows a lot of volatility between growth rates the last decades, and a large part of that is tickers, because you know they can distort growth rates between biennia. And this chart here, which I know we've showed you before, it tends to be one of our sort of favorite charts. The white bars are those that show where actual collections have been and how the growth rates change from time to time. And then the blue bars, which are not quite as volatile and a little more stable, are where revenue collections would have been without either large kicker refunds or the federal pension refund, for example, things that are sort of outside of economic conditions and that are more actions that we have the ability to control. Or sometimes we don't have the ability to control them. So talking about the kicker. I'm just going to move through sort of what the calculation process is for the kicker and some timelines of important dates for it. The May 15th forecast, which we will put out coming up, the May 15th, though, for 99 was the original base for this kicker, changed only by the specific legislative actions that you had during session, which got us to a closed session forecast. If personal collections, personal and all non-corporate collections, are more than 2% above that base, then we have a kicker. Same for the corporate kicker. If all corporate collections are more than 2%, then you have a kicker. Expenditure changes have absolutely no impact on the kicker at all. Kicker refunds and credits are paid out in the following biennium. And that's where we're in this sort of downturn time right now, where we're coming off a really gangbuster biennium, and we've got a large kicker. Now we're having to pay it out in a biennium that we're already seeing a downturn, and so it's sort of giving you a double impact there. So the kicker that we're calling for 99-01 is being paid out in 01-03. And this just sort of gives a timeline. We create the kicker base, the closed session forecast, September 99 for this one. We have the quarterly forecast updates, which this March forecast is one of those. And in those, we have projections where we think things are going to be, how large, well, whether or not we think there's going to be a kicker in the first place, and then how large it's going to be. The kicker is actually certified after actual collections come in for the biennium, so you won't actually see that in a published document until the September forecast, after you're probably long gone and have set a budget. That same forecast is when we will create the next close of session level for next biennium and be sort of the starting point for whether or not there's a kicker next time. And then refunds are paid out in typically October, November, when Department of Revenue actually processes those and gets them out before December 1st. So that sort of just gives you, you know, the timeline of the personal income tax kicker. The corporate is very similar. Timing is a little bit extended because rather than just one big refund that's sent out in November or so, they actually have the ability to use credits against their liability, and so that extends a little bit out into the next year or so. This is the kicker calculation for this forecast. You can see that the personal kicker there is worth $336.7 million above our original projection. So that's what the kicker is going to be. For there to be no kicker, we would have to drop below that 2% threshold, which is the 182.2. So you see that you've got a pretty big drop that you'd have to see in the next few months for there to not be a kicker at all. Corporate, though, you see is below the threshold level right now. It's just about $3 million below. So there is no kicker right now being called for corporate.
Ms. Parker, do you have an average for the individual recipient for the kicker refund?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe it's about 7.9%. And, yes, actually, there it is. You know, I had it somewhere.
If you anticipated it.
Very enthused. Yes, the total is 336.7, but we're looking at about 7.9% of 2,000 liabilities for individual returns. And that'll be, again, paid out in fall of this year. And right now, again, there's no corporate kicker credits currently anticipated. This is just a history of where the kickers have been since the 79-81 biennium. You can see when we were in economic downturn before, there ended up being a shortfall. There have been times, however, looking at 91-92, which, as Tom mentioned, was also sort of a, you know, not as deep as a recession as maybe the 80s, but it was definitely a downturn. There was not a kicker during that time. You can see that while this looks dollar-wise like a fairly big kicker, it's percentage-wise nowhere near being the largest that we've had. So, and you can see that corporate is hasn't followed exactly the same pattern that personal has. There was no kicker for corporate last time, and currently we're not calling for one. So the risks to the forecasts, all the risks that Tom mentioned about the economy, because they drive right into the revenue forecast, they are the same risks that we're facing as well. So how fast employment slows, or whether it slows to the levels that we think it will, all those sort of things that he talked about will impact the revenue forecast as well. Capital gains, I know we've talked about in the past, is very volatile and very difficult to predict. We're expecting that things will level off in the future. What we have in our forecast is consistent with what the Congressional Budget Office has as well, but you know, they've been wrong in the past, we've been wrong in the past, and I think capital gains, just like the stock market and the old 50-50 sort of look at things, is, you know, it's difficult, and it's probably one of the more volatile components of the forecast. Also, this forecast is current law forecast, so it doesn't have any impact of tax law changes that you may make during the session, or it doesn't have any impacts from anything that the federal government, any federal level tax changes that may occur. So to the extent that something were to happen between May 15th or, you know, that we need to bring in from that level as well, that's a risk to this forecast.
Such as a retroactive tax cut at the federal level?
Exactly.
Which would increase tax payments, actually increase revenues to Oregon because of offset?
Correct. 2,000 final payments and refunds are also, but we're right in the middle of tax time right now. So February and March are typically when we send out most of our refunds. So we'll be watching closely to see if what we're projecting as far as refund levels actually are coming true. And then final payments are coming in, you know, sort of March and April time. And so we'll be getting just fairly final information before the May 15th forecast, but there'll still be some volatility there as to what we expect. Withholding has been fairly okay so far, pretty high. Like I said, the last quarter we were well above where we expected the forecast to be. We've seen that slowing somewhat, but not to the levels that you'd think, you know, nothing that's just dropped off as far as withholding is going. So we'll be watching that in the next few months really closely and how it's tracking the forecast.
To what extent does high withholding reflect taxpayers' fear of the tax effect because of rising income? I know people routinely manipulate their withholding to a higher level because they would rather zero out their taxes or have a slight refund come tax time. But if Oregonians feel their income growth potential is flattened out, will that affect withholding?
We've had those same conversations internally. You know, how interactive are people with actually going in and making changes on their, you know, will people go in because of Measure 88, for example, will they go in and actually make changes to their withholding elections to, you know, sort of offset what's expected there? I think our discussion, and Tom, you can, you know, feel free to add, but our discussion is that, you know, it takes a lot of time to go in and talk about how you're going to change your withholding. It, you know, it actually takes some action. You have to go in, and maybe those who are very, you know, very exactly where every dollar is going, and, you know, there are those who will go in and make those changes, but generally, I don't think that there will be a lot of changes to withholding. It'll be more actual income, you know, actual wage and salary levels and employment levels that will impact withholding collections than individuals making changes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George is recognized, and then Senator Crooker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we have about $400 average taxpayer is going to receive back if a kicker is, in fact, issued, then we have a federal tax, particularly if it's retroactive, coming back. Have you guys made any calculations that you think that might do to stimulate the economy? Because that would be a substantial number of dollars ending up in the average taxpayer's hands.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, this particular forecast doesn't have that in it because it's current law.
Right.
But we will assess that to see to what extent, based on that money coming back into people's hands, would generate more economic activity. What I'm encouraged too is that the work with that the Legislative Revenue Office has done on their tax incidence model, I think, will be very useful in this regard to look at those kind of questions.
Okay, but we can't assume that 337, 336.7 would actually yield about $400 to average taxpayer.
Senator George, I typically bring with me the average for different income classes, and unfortunately, I did not bring that with me this morning, but I can get that information for you.
Okay.
Senator Corcoran is recognized.
So, Ms. Parks, the question I have is, you said that the withholdings were higher than you had anticipated. So we get the bad news. I'm trying to simplify this in my Irish mind. We get the bad news today that we're down $113 million. What is, do you have any tea leaf reading theories about May in terms of both the kicker and the income forecast for the general fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I would have to tell you that today we think May is going to be what we're presenting to you as far as March is. That's because that's the economic information that we have right now. That's the revenue collection information that we have right now. But the risks are that either refunds are smaller or larger than we expect them to be, final payments are smaller or larger than we expect them to be. Those are sort of the risks. Right now I would say they were 50-50. For the most part, we're talking about collections other than withholding. We're talking about collections that are based on 2000 and refunds that are based on 2000 and prior years. So, you know, other risks, again, capital gains is a risk. What actually happened? What were real? We know what happened in the stock market, but when did people get out? What did they actually realize? Did they have losses? Did some of them get out in time? They have lots of gains. So those are sort of the risky components. And, there is the possibility that May could be down slightly for this current biennium, could pull the kicker down. If I go back to the collection the amount that we're above threshold is $154.5 million. So to not have a kicker, you'd have to go below, you'd have to be that much below what we are expecting today. And that's a pretty big drop in the next few months. But I'm not going to say it's impossible, because it is entirely possible.
I'd like just to follow up. So your sense is that basically the dependent variables are such that you can't really, with any assuredness, talk about having a lower deficit or a greater deficit. I mean, it's really not easy to call.
At this point, I think we would, we'd say what we're bringing to you today is what we truly believe is going to happen. That's what the economic information and what the actual collection information is telling us today. As we get information that comes in, and we'll be getting final information for February in the next few weeks, actually in the next few days, and we during this season, we track collections and refunds to the extent we can on a daily basis. So we'll be getting a lot of information in, but right now, today, I would tell you that this is what we believe is going to occur.
I'd like to separate the risk to the accuracy of the forecast, which is a risk that we as public policymakers have to be concerned with, and you as our analysts would have to be just in agony over, I'm certain, from the risk that you've also laid out economically, which is a much larger and more direct policy implicator for our making the budgets and the considerations that we do in revenue. There is no doubt that there is a flattening of income. There is no doubt that there is slowing in the economy. There is no doubt that the fourth quarter, as an indicator, clearly indicates that we're in a cyclical downturn. There is no doubt that we've had the manufacturing sector is in recession. There is no doubt that Oregon is more heavily dependent on manufacturing. Those things are not in question. The real question that looms over this budget is whether or not the risk, which you've identified as being higher than any other period in post-war history, of a recession is great, and whether or not we actually will see the rest of Oregon's economy follow manufacturing into recession. So, the risk factors that you lay out, there's some very clear indicators. The question is whether the rest of the economy follows manufacturing into recession. It's nationally indicated that it was in recession. And so the risk for Oregonians and the risk for public policymakers is whether we look at the fourth quarter as an indicative quarter for the biennium, or whether we just hope it's a momentary reversal in a course of slower growth. And I think that prudence is what's demanded here. I think that's real clear. Representative Shetter.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I think this is pretty much what we were anticipating. I feel like I've gone to the dentist with a toothache and come out finding out that I have a cavity.
And hoping it's not a root canal.
Yeah, that's right. Hoping it's not a root canal. It's not the news I wanted, but it was the news I was expecting, I guess. We'll be anxious to see what the... as you say, the risk factors play out, how they play out over the next 2.5 months until we get you back in. I know from Senator Corcoran's question, the speculation has already started what the May forecast is going to be and what the trend line, I think, from that is going to indicate whether we're on a downward trend. But so far, my sense is that this is not out of line with what we expected to find ourselves, where we expected to find ourselves at this point. Appreciate the solid work that will bring it to us.
Senator George?
We'll just kind of get this back in perspective, because we got a lot of citizens who may be listening to this. If we look at what we are just ending up spending through the 9901, a little over 10.1, and then we look over here at this forecasting and reduced at 11.3, we're still talking about about $1.2 billion increase in potential spendable revenue.
I believe it's a 6% growth.
6% growth. Which would be beyond in what inflation rate is.
Right, and then, I think Senator George, your comment's very well made. We have a mixed message for Oregonians. We have a 6% growth in revenue, but we have indicators that are declining. And so that should give us some pause as we consider budget implications for the next 5 years. Colleagues, this has been a very important and informative report. Are there any final questions from the panel for Senator George?
If we go to the website that's listed on the back, will all of these be present there so we could either link to off of our website?
When you say all of
and
we can put them up.
Yes.
They are not there yet, but we can do that.
The forecast is published. The information is available. It will be added to the website by our request. Thank you, Senator George, for the request. If there's no further business to come before the committee, we are in adjournment.
Thank you for the invitation.